questions that could reveal your purpose in life? What if there were questions that could surface the change most meaningful to you? And what if answering those questions would give you the power to ignite? Welcome to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. These are big conversations that lead to self-discovery. Together, let's embark on the leader's journey and ignite meaningful change. Igniting a big vision of change takes real leadership. You have to be able to engage, align, and mobilize all those who can help. But if your change doesn't matter to them, they won't listen or act. So how do you ensure they care about it? First, as Jonathan discovers in this episode, you have to know who they are.
To whom does this matter? We engage only to the degree that something matters to us. Who would find your vision of change meaningful enough to actually help you ignite it? To whom does this matter? We engage only to the degree that something matters to us. Who would find your vision of change meaningful enough to actually help you ignite it?
This is the million-dollar question. You spoke earlier of the first being, though, as opposed to the most, who would be most affected. You said those who tune in. Now we're talking about, yes, those versus tuning out. We tune out when we disengage. Mm. So we engage by tuning in only when it matters to us.
I'm feeling here that we're moving towards how I would go about this. In our previous conversation, we talked about the audience, different parts of the audience, those who would respond in some way positively because the vision resonates with them, those who would reject it, mock it, deride it, and those who might be affected by it even though they're not aware, okay? If I look at this question now, to whom does this matter? It feels like this is about, well, let me put it this way, isn't part of my job to make it matter.
It isn't part of your job to make it matter.
It isn't.
Why not?
Well, if the vision is true and responds to a real need, and is as urgent as I would like to think it is, then that question's already solved.
Meaning they'll intuitively know that it matters?
Well, that takes us back to the group who would recognize its thrust, its sentiment, its objectives, even if they felt there was hearing something new. Yeah.
Is making it matter, maybe this is a Marianne question, is making it matter the same thing as being a salesperson?
No, you're not selling it. And before I answer that, let's go to the underlying assumption of why it's not your job, Jonathan. Let's go back there, please. Help me understand that. What do you expect between, you know, you seeing your vision and them responding to it?
This is the communicator in me talking where, yeah, as I have said to other people, you can have the best idea ever. Yeah. You can have the best idea ever and fail because you don't communicate it well enough. You don't do justice to your idea. At one level, any form of communication, whether it's written, spoken, is about doing justice to the idea. Mm-hmm. Allowing the idea to step forward and grab people's attention. Ultimately, the language is a tool at that point. I mean, language can be beautiful enough, powerful enough to grab somebody's attention. But if we're talking about a vision, it's a means to an end. It's the vision and the spirit behind the vision, the spirit of the vision that should grab people. And the language is at the service of that.
Right. Yeah. But who comes up with, whose job is it to come up with the language?
Well, I would say if it's my vision, that's my responsibility.
Okay.
I have to, in a first instance, I don't, in something as personal as this, I wouldn't, I personally couldn't delegate this to somebody else.
Right. So then how is it not your job to help make it matter to them?
No, but that's what I'm saying. That's what I was saying, isn't this where it begins to be my job now?
Oh, good. Okay. I understood you to say the opposite. Sorry.
I was
going to go to abdicating your leadership responsibility.
No. On the contrary, I was coming around to the idea that, you know, so the question is, to whom does this matter?
Yeah.
And what I was saying there is that it is my job, or it is part of my job to make it matter. Now, if we look at the audience here, if there's a group of people who are just, for reasons of their own view of life, their own experience, their own values, are naturally in tune with the vision, even though they may have not seen it articulated, you would hope that those are the people that are drawn immediately to your vision.
Yeah,
and that you're not working.
But you don't sit back and just count on them to get it.
No,
right?
No, absolutely.
Yeah. And to Catherine's point, it's not about salesmanship.
No, not at all.
We will, of course, delve into how do you make it matter to them?
Yeah.
Right? What goes into that? Mm-hmm. Right now, it's identifying to whom it matters so that you can start to put a face on them.
I think here, I imagine people who at the very least have felt the same, seen, experienced, felt the same suffering, whoever they are.
You mean by suffering that loneliness?
Yeah. Who would find your vision of change meaningful? I mean, if it's about being meaningful, who would find your vision of change meaningful enough so that they help you ignite it?
Exactly. I mean,
it's people who are animated by the same disappointment in how we live today, and who are also have become intolerant of what we currently live.
Ideally, who would do something with your vision?
Would I want to narrow it down? Would be my question. Or at this very first stage, are we limiting, narrowing, labeling?
Not necessarily. However, let's go back to your descriptor of the vision several times again today. What kind of vision was it you first expressed, and do you still stand by that?
What kind of vision?
Yeah, you called it
a political vision.
Yes.
Yeah.
You still stand by that?
Yes, but I do say that feeling that it's that it goes further than that.
Further than that.
Deeper than that. Yeah.
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 Keep going. What do you say?
I'm drawn back to this the image I had of nesting. So just as a nest is a form of home, it's a type of home that a bird would build patiently over time. So we have a nest,
twig by twig.
Yeah, and that there are nests within nests. If we start to look at our human home, and that we begin with culture, and that through living together over a long time in a community, we do things together. We arrive at new traditions. We share values. We voice them. We write them down. We tell each other stories where we say, this is who we are. This is who we are. This is what we believe in. And then out of that nest, or within that nest, there is another nest where we take that culture and we turn it into a set of public institutions, political institutions, ways of sharing power, ways of electing government. And then out of that political community that we create an economic system. And by the way, I forgot one nest earlier. There's out of culture that we create our values. Our values, what we cherish, the things that we believe in, that comes out of the culture. So we move through culture, through values, towards a political system, and then ultimately out of the political system, we reach an economic system. That's how I see things. So my vision, I remember scribbling this down in my notes in London somewhere, that the nest that I'm interested in is the first nest, the nest of our culture, trying to change culture, trying to change how we talk about things, how we see things. Now, that's maybe a reflection of where we are today, that in my own, firstly, my own frustration and disenchantment with our political life today, but also my own personal circumstances where I've become a nomad, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
When you're a nomad, you don't become disenfranchised. Our European Union allows us to vote wherever we live. But still, it's more difficult to participate fully in the political life of a country if you are not from there. And that's normal. That's a normal cultural reality, because history matters, roots matter.
Is your vision, Jonathan, of a shared home within Europe focused on the cultural?
I say culture in a very broad sense here, in the same way that when I use the word political, it's in its broadest sense. And this is why when I talk about fiction, for example, when I talk about the novel, I agree with those writers who believe that the novel is inherently political, even if it doesn't ostensibly talk about a political system or political issues. So it's a novel is political because it's getting to the heart of how we live together, and the choices we make. Mm-hmm. So it's political in the broadest sense. So my vision in that sense, yes, my vision is cultural because it's about the language that we use to describe our world. So it's a language. It's about the values that underpin everything, you know, what we hold to be important, what we believe it means to be human. That question is that's beyond politics. That goes a lot deeper than politics. Mm-hmm. You know, what does it mean to be human? In the context of the arrival of artificial intelligence, and what that is going to mean for us over the next 10, 20, 30 years. There's an urgent political question around regulation. I think we are rightly asking questions about how to regulate this. But at its heart, at its essence, it's a cultural question. If the most important question is what does it mean to be human? So, I mean, further down the line, there's an economic question about, you know, how many jobs are going to be destroyed by artificial intelligence, or how is it going to create new jobs? So the important economic questions further down the line, important political questions right now, how do we regulate this and on what basis? But what I'm interested in is the nest beneath all of this, the nest that holds all of this, which is what's at stake here? What's actually at stake here? What does it mean to be human today?
Mm-hmm. Which is bigger than cultural, political, or any other?
I think culture is cultural in its broadest sense is the word that I'm most comfortable with. Yeah.
So would you say then that this is a cultural vision?
I probably would resist one single adjective. I would be more comfortable talking about a vision of how we live together.
Okay.
And that encompasses.
Yeah.
It encompasses the cultural, the political, all the
dimensions,
economic, all the dimensions.
Yeah. So is that at all? I mean, that's a lot.
Mm.
That's a lot. And when you ask, when we go to the whom does this matter, how narrow do you go? How wide do you go? So if, in fact, you know it encompasses all of those things, does that feel manageable to you? Doable? Because you started with, you know, a few hours ago, political vision.
Yeah. Yeah.
How's it feeling?
If I look at the parts of the world that I've lived in recently and the country where I was born and the country I grew up in, I'm not sure I would go into the political system. I don't think I'd find a home there. I don't think I would be welcome there. I don't think I'd get a hearing there.
Interesting. Yeah. Given you've spent many years.
Sure, sure.
Putting words in the mouths of politicians. Sure. Is that in any way, I'm playing devil's advocate, but is that any way a reflection of your being tainted or wounded by your disillusionment with the political?
Partly. I, again, I'm going to go, I use that word nomad. I'm going to come back to that now because that's, in a sense, that speaks to my own personal circumstances and the choices I've made over the last 2 decades. And there is a cost that comes with that, certain freedoms, but certain costs. And again, this is something that informs my vision. You know, part of me here is saying that my vision is partly a response to the uprooting and the loneliness that I felt myself. But again, I don't shy away from it because certainly as I've gotten older, and certainly over the last 5-10 years, I've started to feel that while the choices I've made statistically are very exotic, what do I mean by that? In the European Union, we talk about the European Union as a place where people can live, work, study in any country that they want, and that's great. Those are the freedoms of the European Union.
With the mobility,
yeah, the
within
mobility.
And among.
Yeah. Yeah. But the number of people who actually do that is tiny, tiny, tiny.
Is it
tiny.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I always wondered.
It's tiny.
And why is that?
Because it's not normal. because the human need for home, to stay at home, is strong. I think what tends to happen, and I've seen this in every country I've lived in, I see it now in Copenhagen. I don't think it's controversial to say that the bright, young, ambitious people of European countries, but also this country, I dare say, correct me if I'm wrong, or the United States, and again, I'm for reasons of respect and modesty, I'm restricting my geographical map here to you know, what we call the West, so Europe and North America. I don't think it's controversial to say that that young people have always been attracted to big cities, the capital city and the other big cities. Why?
Because cultural life.
Cultural life.
Job opportunities.
Job opportunities. I think also...
Education.
Yes. I think also, and this is not a small point, because at some level this takes us back towards the vision.
Yay.
Is the ability to live the life you want to live.
Mm-hmm. And so, mating. No mating? Mating as well. Talking about loneliness.
Yes.
The likelihood of finding multiple city. Potential mates versus
sex.
One village.
Sex
yeah.
in the city. Sex
yeah.
in the
city.
City.
Yeah.
No, absolutely all of these things. I mean, there is a very... I'm putting this out there now. There is a very liberal view of the city, liberal in the proper sort of ancient philosophical sense about freedom, as a place which allows people to live together how they want to live, allows them to choose their own path, but also, and this is where cities are interesting, it also means that the city has to become a place of toleration.
Because of the diversity.
Because of the diversity.
Yeah.
If everybody's on top of each other, you have to find ways of living together.
Sharing a space.
Yeah, you're sharing a space. You're bumping into each other mm-hmm. at all parts of the day. So you have to get on. You have to get on. So, I mean, and that speaks to the life I have led, the life of a nomad. I'm putting that word back in front.
Okay.
Why do you
it's got glaring lights around it. Yeah. I'm just saying.
But I let me just finish that loop again. On the one hand, I think I'm rightly skeptical about the cautious about the roots and the inspiration of my vision, because I say to myself, well, if I have led the life of a nomad and the vast majority of people are not living like nomads, but are, you know, at most going from their small town to the big town, but staying within their country, yeah, then my experience is unusual. It's a little bit exotic. I'm an outlier. So you think, well, oof, am I best placed to talk about the challenges facing society as a whole? But this is where I say, on the other hand, as I've gotten older, I have felt that the uprootedness that I've talked about and the loneliness that I've talked about are widely spread. I don't feel that my experience is so exotic after all. And I do believe, and I think our modern politics proves this, I think it proves my point, I think a lot of people today are feeling uprooted and disoriented and a little bit homeless in that broadest sense that we were using. Mm. They may have a safe and comfortable house around them, a roof over their head. And they go to bed in a nice warm bed, but they nonetheless feel uprooted, dislocated a little bit, certainly fragmented, not feeling that they're part of something. I wanted to talk earlier, to complete our conversation earlier, what's lacking often is a sense of common purpose. Mm-hmm. It's not only that we experience the world in a very fragmented way, and social media is just one aspect of that, but it's also we lack common national projects and a common sense of purpose. And that belongs to a loss of confidence, a loss of hope in the future. So what am I saying here? I'm giving myself a license. I'm giving myself a license to come forward with this vision, in spite of the fact that superficially my life, my nomadic life, is a little bit exotic.
Let's go to nomadic life for a moment.
Please.
Why do you see yourself as a nomad? How long did you live in Belgium, for example?
Well, this is it. This is well said. You've skewered me with your first
holding
argument.
You to account, Jonathan Hill.
You've skewered me immediately. This is interesting. This speaks to the problem. You're absolutely right. And I've asked myself this. I've said to myself, whoa, slow down. You lived in Brussels for 25 years. What is more stable than that?
But it was completely rootless. You didn't live in one place. You didn't have a roof over your head.
Well, this is where I can hear the jeers, the mocking jeers of those people who wanted and succeeded in bringing the United Kingdom out of the European Union. These people would point to me and say, ha, exactly, you know, hoisted by his own petard,
yes.
They would say, yeah, you know, because this is the citizen of nowhere, as Theresa May once said. But it's not true. It's not true. I know this. Every bone of my body, I know that that's wrong. And that was political rhetoric, very effective political rhetoric that served a purpose. You know, hats off, well done.
I hadn't heard that actually, right, Theresa May said that.
It's just not true.
Huh. What was the intent of that?
Well,
I
think it belongs to a much bigger and necessary and good debate about how we live today. The part of it that is right, I think, is that, and this is in line with my vision, and this is why it's so ironic that a Prime Minister of the Conservative Party would say this, because this is, I don't want to get into local party political fights here, but these were the people that had always been most at home with the idea of selling off national assets, whether they're cultural assets, companies allowing, and let's be clear, Britain is not alone in this, but it speaks to the idea of a nameless, homeless, unaccountable form of financial capitalism where money moves around without limit, everything is for sale, and the national institutions, the national government, loses any sense of responsibility for the prospects of its own people. This is why people rightly feel angry and left behind. You know, I'm simplifying massively here, a political debate that's been raging for two decades now. The part of it that is relevant is, I think you can be somebody who has lived in the same town for 20 years, whether it's Brussels or Nottingham, the city that I was born in, and feel equally uprooted and lonely. Okay.
There you go. Now you're getting to the heart of it.
That's what I'm saying. And this comes back to our previous conversation.
It sure does.
The loneliness that we're talking here, and the sense of dislocation, the sense of not belonging to something, the sense of not having a common purpose, is not a function of geographical proximity. It's not a function of how many people are physically around us. We can be in the most intimate family relationships and feel lonely, okay? The loneliness that we feel today is coming from somewhere else. It's not for a lack of bodies around us. And what I'm saying here is that I don't see it as a contradiction that I had a home and a very stable home in Brussels for 25 years. And I call it a home. I call it one of my two or three homes. And it will always be a home until the day I die. Brussels will be one of my homes, one of the most important homes. I became a citizen of Belgium in 2018. what I'm saying here is we can sense, we can feel that we have a nomadic lifestyle. And the word I used to use, and this, looking back, it might be better because slightly less dramatic. I used to talk about my life as that of a journeyman, the journeyman. Wow. Yeah. Which is a great word, journey. The etymology here, the French journée, somebody who would, I presume, work by the day, maybe work for just one day and then move on.
A skilled worker who practices some trade or handicraft.
Yeah.
From, yes, journée, a day's work of travel.
Yeah.
Day's work or travel.
Right. So much wrapped into this. And we should be careful not to go down a rabbit hole here because it's we'll lose the thread. But I think where it's relevant here is the idea of moving from one job to the next, one project to the next, one stage in one's life to the next, and not feeling that it's part of something, not feeling that it adds up to something. Not feeling that there is a story or a sense of purpose behind it.
So there, you don't feel the sum of all of those parts.
Yes.
An overriding connection.
Yeah, yeah. Now that's very personal to me, but I do believe it speaks to something about the way we live today.
I'd like to go into the word nomad if you're
ready.
Yeah,
please.
Okay. Because it can, now you may exchange it for journeyman. They mean very different things. But given that you've been talking about your vision of a shared home and you've spoken about the homeless and where that manifests both externally and internally, the definition of nomad is a member of a people who have no permanent home, but move according to the seasons and literally wandering homeless. So no permanent home.
Yeah.
So have you to that degree been homeless, Jonathan? Do you consider yourself homeless?
Yes and no. The immediate sense, no, because I want to, out of a sense of propriety and respect here, I want to stick to the first definition first, which is the most urgent. The people who simply don't have a bed tonight, those are the people, the only people I care about right now, you know, as we have this conversation. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, in 2023, it's just intolerable. Mm-hmm. So I want to be really clear about that.
Well, so your vision is designed to help them to alleviate that level of homelessness in part.
Yes.
In part, right?
Yes.
Create okay.
Absolutely. I mean, it would be that part of the vision. I think this is, we're sort of getting into the political vision. I think it was John Rawls that talked about this. My brain does not have the capacity to do justice to his philosophy, but I remember that one of the most important ideas in his idea of justice is that, I'm going to paraphrase here, but what matters most about a particular community and how it's organized is how it treats its most vulnerable.
Yeah.
So necessarily, we begin with the homeless. Mm-hmm. And the children who are hungry.
Because that's what you want to address, the contrast between what is and what could be. Yes. This question, however, is different from who is most affected. Mm. This is saying, to whom does this matter enough to actually help you ignite your vision?
Mm. Well, from this point in the conversation now, where we are now, I feel that there are people who would feel the sense of homelessness in its broadest sense, who I think would find this meaningful enough. So I'm talking here about that sense of dislocation, the sense of not having a common purpose, the disenfranchised, as you said, Marianne, to use your word. That's the wider group here who don't have a shared home at the moment, who don't have a sense of home in its broader sense.
How do you see them helping you realize it?
Is it an inspiration that they derive from hearing your words and glimpsing at your vision that inspires them to take action within their own communities? Could it be at that level?
Grassroots, sort of.
This is probably why I use the word cultural. That as things stand today and how I feel today in my own life and how I've seen, you know, the communities that I've lived in over the last decade or more, that mainstream politics would not provide the platform, would not be the first place I would go to.
Why not?
Because it's too hardened and too wrapped up in the idea of preserving itself as it is today.
Because of what it is today. But what if you see what it could be that it isn't yet? Could that be a channel? Could that be a door through which?
At some point in the future, I would want the political system itself to be able to respond to this. Yes.
At what point, Jonathan? What point? And what would happen if they did? Let's go there. What do you see?
Well, who's the they? Here?
Yeah, who is the they?
I mean, my frustration with... I mean, the one I talked about most in most detail was the current British system. And my point there, it goes to the heart of the vision. I remember saying this. Goes to the heart of my vision, because if you have what is essentially a two-party system. The British system is not formally a two-party system. It would describe itself as a multi-party system. But if we have one Green Member of Parliament in 2023, one, that proves my point, that it is in its most important aspects a two-party system, a sort of oligopoly, if you like, or a duopoly.
So does Britain's exit from the European Union at all affect your vision of that shared home within Europe?
Yes, but this is getting too personal now, where we're drilling down too much into my own personal circumstances, and I'm trying to...
Okay, that's fine.
I'm trying to sort of push away from that.
I want to stay at the height of your vision, though.
Yeah.
Right? Because, again, the question is, to whom does this matter? When you look at the ideal, whatever that looks like politically, if the political leaders, the political systems, the governing levels from national to regional to local to municipal, if those were in whatever idealized state to respond to this, could you even see that they could be in an ideal state at some point, ideal enough to respond to this, to help you realize it?
No, because again, it's you know, if I go back to the idea of nesting, the nest I'm interested in is that broader cultural one.
Who governs cultural life?
Nobody. It's a free-for-all, rightly.
Okay.
But you have to it is necessary. It is rightfully and necessarily chaotic. That's what a cultural scene should be.
So if this is then a cultural vision, and cultural is admirably chaotic, who then, where does any policy relate to any of this? If culture starts erupting, if there are movements within it, challenges to it, redefinitions of it, what do those result in? And where does the eradication of homelessness come from? Is that going to be a cultural manifestation? Or is there policy that goes with that? What? I'm extrapolating here wildly.
And this is the it's not a contradiction, but it's there's a nut here that's going to be very hard to crack, because we've circled around this now in this part of the conversation. The vision I've articulated is a mix of, it comes from my own experience, my own ideas about how things could and should be, my sense of what has become intolerable. But it also comes up against a reality in my own life, which is this, you know, what I've called nomadic, uprooted lifestyle, and where, you know, I'm now finding my feet in a new city. So where is the place that I go to express this vision? And that's probably why I'm moving, you know, being drawn to the cultural, that broader cultural sphere, because I don't feel at the moment that, I mean, to put it in very simple, practical terms today, so December 2023, I could not take this vision into the Danish political sphere, for example, for all sorts of reasons.
Why not? Just out of curiosity.
Well, because I'm not sure, I don't feel yet that I know my Danish neighbours well enough. I don't feel I have a legitimacy to talk about how they organise themselves. I can have an opinion. I mean, I live there. I pay my taxes there. I'm just not sure I have a real sort of moral legitimacy, or even the experience to take this forward there. And also, I would probably say that in my experience of Denmark so far, the country in some ways is close to the vision that I set out.
Closer, perhaps.
Closer, yeah. And where some of the ills that I've talked about are not so present in Denmark. And I think that's, if you close the loop, that's probably one of the factors why I've ended up.
Yeah, not a coincidence. So maybe Denmark serves for you as a manifestation of what is possible. Not ideal, not perfect, but possible.
I remember having a conversation with my partner about this, that I remember saying to her once, a couple of years back, that it was not arbitrary, it was not by coincidence that we had somehow ended up here, that we were probably drawn by a number of things.
Values.
Right. And absolutely, that's exactly the word I would use as well.
And yet within those values that drew you, you're experiencing a difference within the culture. And less of a, again, devil's advocate, sense of belonging fully yet within that culture.
Yes. But I think that's, I feel that that's normal and natural. I think these things take time.
Are you accustomed to that as a nomad? Not having a permanent home, having many homes, but none permanent.
It
sounds amazing.
I think that's the thing here. The only thing I can say that makes sense to me here is that you can live in a place which is in tune, not perfectly, but is mostly in tune with your idea of what a good society is, and that is broadly speaking in tune with your own values. Mm-hmm. But you can still feel a sharp sense of needing things to change. And I guess I'm feeling my way here because I've not been confronted with this in a conversation like this. There's probably something here about our European condition where we can move from one country to another and live in different countries and still retain a sense of the problems that are there across the Union as a whole. I mean, that's I've got to be careful here because this is speaking to a European ideal which seems like a holy grail to some. I wouldn't use that. I wouldn't attach that sort of spiritual or religious significance to it, but some people believe that at one point in the future we will have, you know, a European political community, or that there'll be a European public opinion would be the language of political science. I've never believed that that's necessary. I'm comfortable with the idea that we retain our national politics, our national cultures. The only thing I'm saying here, perhaps as a nomad, is that we can move around, we can live in different countries and become sensitive to the problems and the crises across borders. But again, that may be just my own experience.
When you use the term the European ideal, can you view your vision in that context and not in the context of a definition by others, such as the Holy Grail sort of implications? Mm. Is there a European ideal you can see of a shared home?
Yeah, and that's, for me, it has to be, it is necessarily European. And again, I feel it's important that I underline this, that there's a proper sense of modesty here where I can only talk with confidence about the place I know and the place I've lived.
But that is your focus, is it not? The idea of a European shared home.
Yes.
So let's go back to Denmark and your discomfort at acting there politically to, quote, change. First of all, Denmark is, if you look at Europe as a whole, Denmark would be at the individual or the micro level of the change. One of many European countries that together would share, in part, be bound as a collective by a vision, right, of a shared home. Why don't you take it to the macro level? Because this question is, who can help you realize it? Mm. Now, your answer to that initially, and you may rest there, Jonathan, this question is designed to help you identify who do you need to speak to amplify this in order to incite, compel, what those are not meant to be negatives, them to think and act in the ways that will together as you engage this collective and align them in thought and action with you to realize this vision of a shared home. Who do you need to reach?
Yeah. I mean, if we're now at the stage where do you are you encouraging me to name groups of people, institutions?
Sure. Yeah. Put literally as much as you can, put a face on it.
Okay.
Know to whom you're speaking.
Right.
Because you know, I think I've probably already cited this. David Thoreau said, you can only hit what you aim at.
Yeah.
If you start to speak about your vision in such broad strokes, it becomes generic, first of all, because it's not being expressed in a way that is specifically meaningful to those specific groups or individuals that can help you achieve it. Mm-hmm. Big vision. It would take you many lifetimes to achieve it just on your own, yeah?
Right, but this is, okay, this is where there's a step that's missing for me here.
Okay.
Because what I've not declared yet in our conversation is the form that this vision would take. So I feel very clear. I feel very confident using the words that I've used mm-hmm. to articulate the vision. But what I've not said yet, and I think the reason for that is I'm not sure that I have the answer, is, okay, does that amount to the mission statement of a new political party? Question mark.
You're getting to the how, yeah.
Does it, is it the manifesto? Is it the first manifesto of that political party? Is it the outline of a political book that would set out the vision? Or is it the synopsis of a film project, which might be a documentary? Mm-hmm. Question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark. Because if we've not identified and agreed on the vehicle, then I'm not sure we can say, because so far what I've tried to do is build a bridge from the vision, as I've articulated it, to the question here. So to whom does this matter? So I've just stuck with, for me, this is the vision. And I've tried to answer this question by just leaving the vision as it is, not encased, not wrapped up in anything like the clothes of a manifesto or a political party or the project for a book or a documentary. I've just left the vision there. I don't know, do I need to spell out what form the vision takes?
I think the writer in you is dominant here. And let me answer that by saying, would a political manifesto be of interest and concern to a lonely person walking down the street? Would they read it? Would they understand it? Would they want to hear it?
No, no.
Okay. Would a new political party be of interest to a cultural group within Europe?
Yeah.
Possibly.
Right. But only in a world where, only in a country where a new political party has any chance of, I mean, if you look at Britain, and this is a detail, but it's an important detail. If you create a new party in Britain, everybody, in my experience, everybody laughs and shoots you down. Mm-hmm. All new parties are jeered, sneered mm-hmm. at. Mm-hmm. There's a collective, you know, the machine kicks in and spits
sure.
out.
Absolutely, with venom sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's take this to the organizational. You've written speeches for countless political leaders. You ran communications.
I've written for many different types of leader. Speeches I wrote for the president of the European Commission.
Okay, yeah. So good. Okay, but you've written many different types of speeches over the years.
Yep.
And different types of communications aside from speeches. So your own experience may confirm this. I hope it doesn't. But my experience is, a leader in an organization or political leader, their team, their staff typically writes a speech based on, my leader is speaking next Wednesday at such and such forum. So I'm going to write what my leader needs to say. I can tell you from my assessment of hundreds of executive and other political leaders' communications that most of those communications do not at all reflect who is listening. They are written strictly from the I perspective. This is what I need to say. That is transmitting when you come to communication. That is not ensuring by design that your words, your messaging is being received. So at best, it's one way. Being received is two-way. Leadership communication not only has to be transmitted and received two-way, it needs to be responded to shape, to influence how people think and act in order to ignite a change. So how can you begin to identify the vehicle when you don't know who it is you need to reach based on who can help you achieve it?
Right. Well, I agree with that. But I'm not sure I can go beyond what I've said so far. So
as to who?
I've said that, you know, in the previous conversation I said was the previous question, who will this affect?
Most affect. Yeah.
See, this is where I'm struggling. For me, to whom does this matter? And whom is this affected?
Mm.
Who is affected by this? There is a difference, but it feels like a slight marginal difference.
But look at the tail end of that second prompt phrase. Who would find your vision of change meaningful enough to actually help you ignite it?
And I would go back to what I said when I first answered the question, which is probably the people with whom it would resonate, because they would be naturally in tune with it, even if they've not seen it before. Yeah, I mean, who would find it meaningful? What can I say? Probably the people who would see it, hear it, and think, ah, this makes sense.
So the more you can literally put a face on those people, delineate who they are, it may be they're within a sample, a group, there are different segments. Maybe there are people who, for whatever reason, are nomads. Maybe it wasn't forced upon them themselves. So then there are others who are so fractured from within. Mm-hmm. They're homeless from within. Mm-hmm. Then there could be others that are okay or seemingly okay, but they're concerned about their neighbors being in that state. Mm-hmm. So the more you can identify them, Jonathan, and you don't have to do it this moment, but you're going to have to do it before we get on to the next card tomorrow. Because until you identify them, you won't be able to surface how exactly to reach them with your words.
But what's the key? What are the parameters of how I identify them if we've not yet agreed what the vehicle is for the vision?
Okay, we're going backwards here. That's okay. This was a rather challenging conversation. Given Jonathan's background as a professional communicator, I thought this would be an easy one for him. Not so much. There was resistance here. First, he said it wasn't even his job to make it matter. And then minutes later, he said that it was. And that's understandable given the magnitude of his vision. It's a huge responsibility that can weigh heavily on single shoulders. And that's exactly why it's so essential to make it matter to others so they can help. For now, he can't or won't see beyond the how, the vehicle, to the who. There was yet more resistance. He and we will persevere, because knowing who would find your vision of change meaningful is a critical step in this amplified stage of the Illumify Game Changer. This is where you ensure you express your change in the way that makes it meaningful to those who can help you realize it. And how do you do that unless you know to whom it would even matter? The leader's journey continues. Stay tuned. If listening to this Illumify Game Changer podcast is of value to you, please like it on this platform and share it with those who could ignite meaningful change. It's here, as am I, to be of service. I'm Marianne Gobet. Thank you for accompanying us on the Leader's Journey. To fully experience the passage to igniting meaningful change, subscribe to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. To learn more about the Illumify Game Changer and how to embark on your own leader's journey, please visit Illumify's website at illumifyinstitute.com. You matter. Step up. Speak up. Together, let's ignite meaningful change.